From Public Radio International, this is The World. A co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Today is Monday, February 7th. I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. In Egypt, the new cabinet tries to restore the economy, but protesters say the issue is the immediate departure of Hosni Mubarak. Also ahead, Chinese Americans are speaking less in such regional dialects as Cantonese and more in Mandarin. One resident of Chinatown isn't happy about the trend.
Most people see Mandarin as being really pale and humorless, you know, and it's not a language you can make love in or fight with, you know, whereas Cantonese is something else.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with Mended Hearts to provide online and hospital support to newly diagnosed heart disease patients. Learn more at mendedhearts.org. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. The popular protests in Egypt are still going strong 2 weeks after they began, but there was a different wrinkle in the story today. The new Egyptian cabinet held its first full meeting. The agenda was to put the economy back on the road to normalcy. The urgent nature of that goal became clear this morning when the Egyptian currency fell to a six-year low against the dollar. International investors are feeling anxious about the continuing unrest, but The World's Matthew Bell is finding evidence of renewed economic activity in Cairo.
Schools and the stock market are still closed, but banks and businesses have started opening again. Another sign that Cairo is beginning to get back to some semblance of normal life, traffic jams. Making ends meet has not been easy since huge demonstrations first paralyzed Cairo at the end of last month. Iman is in her 30s. She's from a poor neighborhood called Imbaba, and she makes a living cleaning houses for people with money.
In the last few days, we couldn't find food, but now the curfew has been extended. There's food. Prices rose. The price of bread, potatoes, our daily food, but now the prices are coming back down. People still can't go to work. There are government employees sitting at home. And people like us who work by the day, they mostly don't have work.
Iman says some of the youth from her neighborhood have gone to join the demonstrations, but she's skeptical of the movement that began on the 25th of January.
What the young people from January 25th asked for, the president granted. We don't know who the people in Tahrir Square are now. We hear it's the Muslim Brotherhood, we hear it's Al-Qaeda, we just don't know.
Egypt's state-run news channels are actively stoking those fears that radicals will take over if President Hosni Mubarak is forced to leave. When this radio announcer accused America, Israel, and Iran of sponsoring the demonstrations in Cairo, my taxi driver nods his head in agreement. He subscribes to the belief that foreign powers are trying to destroy Egypt and its economy. Hopefully, he says, things here will get back to normal as quickly as possible. At a butcher shop in the upscale Zamalek neighborhood, a man cutting up lamb chops tells me he can't talk. The police are back on the streets, and they have been warning business owners not to speak with foreign reporters. That's actually another sign of normalcy here. Down the street, a customer at a falafel shop says he's been getting along just fine, even though he hasn't returned to work yet. In the meantime, he says he and his friends are buying food and medical supplies to help the demonstrators and soldiers in Tahrir Square.
We try to do that. We belong there for the good of this country and to try to ameliorate this country as much as possible.
Demonstrators in the square continue to be defiant, saying they'll stay until President Mubarak goes. Ahmed Amr is a volunteer doctor. He says it's been getting harder to bring in medical supplies because they've been getting confiscated by authorities.
How long can you continue to take care of everyone?
Forever.
Forever. You seem very confident. It must be difficult.
I can't be at home, not move them. I was going and come. But last 3 days, I'm stable here.
One demonstrator tells me he's been in the square since day two of the protests. He says people are eating donated food, sleeping on the ground, and digging into their savings if they have to. And as for the most basic of needs, that's being met through donations of a sort as well.
There's a bathroom.
Public toilets, and sometimes we go to some of the houses and knock on the door.
لكن كل ده في سبيل حرية بلدنا هنتحمله وهنتحمل أكتر من كده.
If this is the price for freedom, we're willing to pay it happily.
Then I mention the claims that foreign elements are at work here, including the U.S., Israel, and Iran, which are coming from the official Egyptian media.
The Iranians are the enemies of the Israelis and the Americans. How can they unite for a common cause? They're just abusing the fact that many people are illiterate and uneducated, and they believe this sort of rhetoric.
Shadi Al-Ghazali Harp is a protest organizer from one of the opposition parties. He says the Egyptian government is trying to outlast the demonstrators. Harp says the demonstrations are not something driven by a single party or political leader, and especially not the government.
It's the people who will decide, not us and not them. The people who want to participate. If they really are seeking freedom, then I think they have to join us.
As far as returning to normal life, many of the protesters insist that can only begin to happen when President Mubarak steps down. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell in Cairo.
At least one aspect of normal life in Egypt is not likely to change, regardless of when President Mubarak leaves office, and that is the role of the military.
The military has been the backbone of the Egyptian state since 1952.
Robert Springborg is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California.
Most Egyptians find it virtually inconceivable to imagine their state without a vital role for the military. So for a transition to move away from military dominance to a situation of civilian political control, the modalities of that and the end state of that are really basically unimaginable for most Egyptians.
Mubarak, we know, sees himself as a military man. This is key to our understanding about how he governs. But how close is he with the military?
His private life and his institutional position are entirely caught up with the military. He lived his whole life in a military compound, as do all Egyptian military officers. It's a world unto itself, and he presents that worldview to the rest of us.
And how about in terms of officialdom? I mean, is he the equivalent of our commander-in-chief? Does he have an official position with the military?
The Egyptian constitution has 35 articles assigning power to the president, more than any other constitution with which I'm familiar. So he's not just a sort of informally in charge of the military. He's vested constitutionally with a range of powers, including appointment and promotion in the officer corps.
So when we hear from generals that they are going to protect the protesters, does that mean that it's really Mubarak who's saying that, despite what we might think?
Yes, it's Mubarak saying that exactly, because he wants to ensure that the reputation of the military remain intact. Because were the military to have tried to control the protesters, it would have been very clumsy indeed, because they don't have any crowd control capacities. They simply have heavy weaponry and 30-caliber machine guns. So for the military not to have blood on its hands was vital for the continuation of military rule.
I think it's helpful to know just how well the military is treated in Egypt, and really the members don't live too shabbily in and around Cairo. Back in 2009, we actually got a good glimpse of this from the BBC's reporter Magdi Abdelhadi, who took a spin around to see the privileges that members of the Egyptian military enjoy.
I'm riding one of Cairo's battered old taxis in Heliopolis, east of the capital. And in this area, you can clearly see the extent of privileges the military officers enjoy. All the time I'm talking to you, we're driving past one club after the other. And these are clubs for the military officers, complete with restaurants, sports facilities, and even hotels. No other profession in Egypt enjoys the same range of facilities as the military officers.
So here's the question then, Professor Springborg. If the military enjoys all those perks, And if being a member of the military means having a steady paycheck, having a hand in business enterprises, why would it be that the military would have so much of the sympathies of the public and vice versa?
Well, I personally don't believe the military does have tremendous sympathy with the public. The higher up one goes in the military, the more one is enmeshed in these networks, which lead down from Mubarak through the Minister of Defense into the officer corps. And the way in which it's done is it's not that serving officers are enmeshed in these military enterprises. It's the promise of being enmeshed in them that maintains their loyalty until they retire, because a retirement check from the Egyptian military is not enough to keep body and soul together. So they're looked after in precisely the way that Magdi Abdelhadi was just describing, but then the lure of a very lucrative life after retirement is what cements the loyalty.
So is the appearance that the military is really supporting the public just for show?
Just for show.
Do you feel as though you have a strong take on what Mubarak's plans are and how he's maneuvering this right now?
He's still got his fingers on most of the control levers. And to be honest, he wouldn't mind having other sympathetic figures pull the levers so long as his interests are protected when he is no longer president. Because the minute he doesn't have, directly or indirectly, his hands on the levers of power, then the power to investigate the resources of the Mubarak clan and the people around them is there. And once that happens, it's not just President Mubarak who's got problems, it's many other people, and there are billions of dollars at stake here. So he cannot just happily walk off into exile. He's got to keep control in Cairo or the game is over.
Robert Springborg, professor at the Naval Postgraduate School in California, Monterey, California, talking to us about the Egyptian military's role and what that role is likely to be as events unfold in Egypt. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You can find our coverage of Egypt, including reports from Cairo and interviews with top thinkers on the subject. It's all at theworld.org/Egypt, a wide variety of stories to check out there. Another struggle for power is taking place on the other side of the African continent. Laurent Gbagbo has been the president of Ivory Coast for more than a decade. He claims he still is. But Alassane Ouattara says he won last November's election, and the international community agrees with Ouattara. Today, the African Union began meeting with members of Gbagbo's government. The meeting is a last-ditch effort to find a peaceful resolution to the political crisis. The BBC's John James is in Ivory Coast's main city, Abidjan. What can the African Union bring to the table to try and end the stalemate?
Yes, and the African Union are saying this is very much the last opportunity to find a peaceful settlement. They had their big annual heads of state meeting at the end of January, and they've come up with this solution, which is a panel of five heads of state who have got a month to try and come out with some sort of solution to resolve this crisis. And so we've had a panel of experts who work for these heads of state who arrived at the weekend. They started work this Monday, and they'll be meeting with all sides here on the ground for 4 days and then trying to come up with some sort of solution to give to the heads of state, who'll then come themselves probably in about a couple of weeks.
Well, what kind of political persuasive powers might they be able to exercise that the wider international community so far hasn't?
Well, I have to say not many people here are hopeful about this mission. Most people think it's probably destined to fail, if you like, because of the fact that, firstly, their mandate is very restricted. The African Union is not going back on its position, recognizing Alassane Ouattara as the rightful president-elect, the position held by most of the world, really, apart from here on the ground where Laurent Gbagbo is refusing to budge. So in terms of their mandate, it seems to be to try and find a negotiated, honorable exit for Laurent Gbagbo.
I wonder if people in Ivory Coast are looking at what has happened in Tunisia, what's happening right now in Egypt as well.
Yeah, I mean, you can see people drawing the same references. Clearly, there are similarities, the heads of state wanting to stay on in the teeth of a popular protest. But there hasn't been the sort of street-level protest that we've seen in North Africa. Basically, the forces of law and order loyal to Laurent Gbagbo have been extremely severe in cracking down on any protests.
All right, the BBC's John James in Abidjan, Ivory Coast. Thank you for the update, John.
Thank you.
Another reason for Israel to worry about instability in Egypt coming up in the second half of our program. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from the Medtronic Foundation, committed to changing the way the world treats chronic disease. Learn more at Medtronic.com. Medtronic, innovating for life.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Yesterday's Super Bowl broadcast featured the usual commercials for cars and soda and beer and more cars. Some of the ads featured sexual innuendo and vulgar humor, and yet you don't hear all that much of an outcry. Apparently, it's getting pretty hard to offend viewers. But The World's Jason Margolis tells us about one commercial that managed to do just that.
The advertisement begins in earnest as a plea for the Tibetan people living under Chinese rule.
Mountainous Tibet. One of the most beautiful places in the world. This is Timothy Hutton. The people of Tibet are in trouble. Their very culture is in jeopardy. But they still whip up an amazing fish curry. And since 200 of us bought at Groupon.com, we're each getting $30 worth of Tibetan food for just $15.
The two-year-old company Groupon, which sells group discounts, also spoofed the causes of saving the whales and the Brazilian rainforest. The advertising message was intended to be this: save something valuable and save money using our coupons. It didn't necessarily work.
The ad is crass and greedy, and it's poking fun at philanthropy, which typically doesn't go over very well.
Wendy Melillo is an assistant professor of communication at American University in Washington. She says for an advertisement to be effective, it has to do two things: get noticed and change behavior. She says the Groupon advertisement scores very well in the first category. The Tibet commercial has created tremendous buzz in online chat rooms and social media sites today. But Melillo says with the second category of changing customer behavior,
it fails miserably because it's kind of a bait and switch, and people don't like that because the hook draws you in and you're thinking one way, and then the switch at the end, I think, has rightly angered people.
Advertisers have long tried to slightly offend and provoke to grab our attention. But you have to know which topics are out of bounds, says Charles R. Taylor, professor of marketing at the Villanova School of Business. The cause of Tibet is one of those topics.
Yeah, in many ways, I think it presents Americans in a bad light in that it suggests that the plight of the people in Tibet is not all that important relative to getting a good deal when a relatively wealthy American goes out to eat.
The director of the organization Free Tibet, Stephanie Brigden, also felt the advertisement was in bad taste, but she does find a silver lining.
If it raises the profile of Tibet, obviously that's positive. People need to understand what's going on. What would be great if this now kind of pricks people's consciousness into saying, actually, I need to do something. And then it will have a really great outcome.
The company Groupon said the advertisements were parodies meant to poke fun at themselves. They're also offering matching donations up to $100,000 to support the causes they made fun of. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
You can check out that controversial ad at theworld.org. Yesterday in New York, dancers, marching bands, and revelers dressed as pink bunnies and paraded through Chinatown. They were celebrating the Year of the Rabbit. Now, it wasn't all that long ago you'd hear a variety of Chinese dialects at such events in Chinatowns across the U.S. Increasingly, though, Mandarin is displacing those dialects. That may be inevitable, given that immigrants are arriving from so many different regions of China. But the trend toward one language doesn't sit well with some residents of Chinatown. Nina Porzuki introduces us to one woman who's on a mission to save her dialect, Cantonese.
Hey ho! Kim.
Every Thursday night, you can find Kim Mui at a noisy cafe in the heart of Manhattan's Chinatown.
So everybody, this is the conversational class. Some of y'all need to speak Guangdonghua, right? Or Cantonese.
Mui teaches Cantonese lessons to adults, and she's animated, jumping out of her seat as her students strain to hear her over all the sounds in the cafe.
Everybody say lo
ya go. Lo ya go.
Like, what does that mean?
Mui doesn't make any money teaching Cantonese. Her students pay no tuition, just donations. There are no fancy flashcards, just a book she's put together over nearly a decade of teaching.
I learned that my ancestors, who are Cantonese, they came to America during the Gold Rush, and they came to build the United States Transcontinental Railroad, and I know they struggled a lot. They helped to build this country, and a lot of people don't know about it. So I want to pay tribute to my ancestors by teaching other people Cantonese, because I know a lot of people want to learn it. That's why I'm doing it.
A decade ago, the majority of Chinese Americans were of Cantonese origin, and Cantonese was the Chinese dialect spoken in Chinatown. Not so anymore. New immigrants from different regions of China have brought different dialects like Fuzhou and Hakka. Chinese shares a common writing system, But when spoken, each dialect is mutually unintelligible. And this is way more than just tomato-tomato, says Julie Tay, director of the Asian Cultural Exchange, a learning center in New York's Chinatown.
So you have no structural differences in the expression, I love you, for example. In Mandarin, it's 我爱你, and in Cantonese, it's 我爱你.
But it looks exactly the same.
In written form, it would be the same.
So no matter which Chinese dialect any two people speak, they can share the same newspaper, they can
read the same article and laugh, you know, about the same things, but they may not be able to speak to one another.
Tay says that more and more speakers of Cantonese and other dialects are turning towards the northern dialect of Mandarin. Mandarin is the default, the broker dialect between dialects. The growing influence of Mandarin in New York mirrors, to a certain extent, what's happening more forcefully in China. Every city, every town even in China, speaks some dialect variety.
Now, so many people are moving around that they must turn to Mandarin.
This is lexicographer David Prager Branner. He says the Chinese government is stepping up its enforcement of Mandarin as the lingua franca of the country. Children speak Mandarin in school, Mandarin is used for government business and commerce, and as Mandarin becomes ever more necessary to communicate.
There are a lot of people who simply don't know the language of their grandparents. Now, in America, that's not unusual. Your parents come from, you seem to have a Polish surname, right? Do you know any Polish?
One word.
All right. It doesn't bother us so much. China is a huge country. You know, it's got one government, okay, but culturally it's like Europe. It's all these different local societies that could easily be different countries. And local language is a big part of what makes you feel that you are who you are.
This was especially apparent this summer in the Cantonese-speaking province of Guangdong. A politician proposed that regional TV news be broadcast in Mandarin instead of Cantonese. His comments sparked demonstrations. Protesters held up signs that read, "If you can't understand what we're saying, then go back to where you came from." Julie Tay says Beijing was quick to recant the politician's proposal.
Whoever this official was saying that, oh, of course, you know, we didn't mean to eliminate Cantonese. Cantonese culture will continue to be strong and to flourish and everything, you know, those typical party lines. But the guy was saying it all in Mandarin.
In New York City, no one is enforcing Mandarin over Cantonese. And, says Tay, while Mandarin is increasingly used for the mundane, day-to-day interactions between neighbors,
most people see Mandarin as being really pale and humorless. You know, and it's not a language you can make love, you know, fight with, you know? Whereas Cantonese is something else.
Of course, she would think that. Cantonese is her native tongue. And it's still the native tongue for more than 70 million people in China and around the world.
We're going to go around.
Back at the Chinatown Cafe, Cantonese teacher Kim Mui shrugs off the notion that her first language could be replaced by Mandarin. It won't if she has anything to do with it. But as Mandarin continues to gain influence, it will take many people, as dedicated as she is, to ensure that their kids can speak more than one word in Cantonese. For The World, I'm Nina Porzuki.
You can find stories galore and interviews on languages and trends in our weekly podcast, The World in Words. It's at theworld.org/language. I'm Lisa Mullins. Coming up, most Americans would consider Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir to be black, but Sudanese don't.
Bashir is an Arab. Bashir is not black. Bashir is a kind of a chocolate kind of a color. It's a color which is not black totally.
PRI's The World is brought to you by the Medtronic Foundation, partnering with Mended Hearts to provide online and hospital support to newly diagnosed heart disease patients. Learn more at mendedhearts.org. And by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The protests in Cairo are shaking up Egypt's neighbor, Israel. The main worry among Israelis has been the future of their peace treaty with Egypt. But another concern erupted this past weekend. An explosion at a natural gas pipeline led to a cutoff of Egyptian gas. Now, Israel gets more than 40% of its gas from Egypt, and it has a long-term deal to keep that gas coming. But Daniel Estrin reports that the shut off of the pipeline illustrates the risk that Israel faces in relying on Egypt as a key energy supplier.
Israeli officials have been assuring the public that they would secure the supply of natural gas from Egypt to Israel. But some nervous Israelis fear that those assurances went up in flames on Saturday. A massive fire erupted at a natural gas terminal in the Sinai Desert. The Egyptian gas company says a gas leak caused the fire. But Egyptian security officials say that someone had detonated a bomb. The gas company contained the fire and shut off the pipes that pump gas to Jordan and Syria. The pipeline to Israel runs nearby, so Israel shut off that one pipeline just to be safe. Still, Israel's National Infrastructure Minister, Uzi Landau, told Israeli radio that everything will be okay, at least in the short term. Landau said, Israel has been prepared for the possibility of gas disruptions for a while. The infrastructure minister said Israel could switch to other fuel sources. But energy consultant Gina Cohen says that won't be an ideal solution to a shortage of natural gas.
Fuel oil can be used in the natural gas power stations. We can replace the gas with fuel oil. But the alternatives to gas will be more expensive and more polluting.
Cohen says those alternatives could cost 10 times more than gas, and Israel is moving away from its reliance on those materials. But Israelis also worry that the turmoil in Egypt could mean more disruptions to the vital pipeline, and some Israelis worry that a new regime in Egypt could be more hostile to Israel and cut off the gas. Energy expert Brenda Schaefer from the University of Haifa says it's a bad idea for Israel to depend on Egypt for so much of its natural gas, regardless of the political situation in Cairo.
Egypt consumes domestically about two-thirds of its natural gas production, and it's going up all the time, and it leaves less and less for export.
And that means gas supplies could dry up for Israel. The infrastructure minister promises to pull out all the stops to ensure Israel's energy security. He wants to push ahead with plans to build a platform in the Mediterranean Sea to receive boats of liquefied natural gas from abroad. But that idea has its critics. They say it would be costly, and it would scream to terrorists, I am a vital energy source for Israel. Blow me up. There is another less controversial possibility. The infrastructure minister called on Israel to speed up the development of recently discovered natural gas fields off Israel's coast. Energy expert Brenda Schaefer says the cutoff of Egyptian gas should encourage not only the drilling, but a reconsideration of what to do with the gas once it's extracted.
For instance, when the discoveries were first made, there was a lot of interest in export. You know, you got this gas, sell it off, we're going to become Gulf states rich, and a lot of excitement. And I think it wasn't a very prudent policy, because you want to keep reserves for 40, 50 years use. You don't want to, you know, sell it off and have yourself caught without energy supplies.
And if Egypt becomes an unreliable provider of gas, those offshore gas fields may not be a luxury for Israel. They may be a necessity. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
The protests that have spread to parts of the Arab world began in Tunisia. Weeks of unrest in the North African country swept out the autocratic president last month. Now a caretaker government is running Tunisia. Presidential elections are set to be held there in the next 6 to 7 months. But the dust hasn't settled, not by any means. This past weekend, there were more violent protests in Tunisia. Tunisian leaders are trying to tamp down the tensions. Sabri Benachour is a reporter for WAMU in Washington, D.C. He's just back from Tunisia. Sabri, I wonder what's changed in Tunisia since the president fled, and if the people of Tunisia got the revolution that they were looking for.
You know, I'd say they're getting it. They're getting it. Right now, there's basically a monumental national operation to put the country back together. So everywhere from press freedom, liberty, internet freedom, investigations into unfathomably vast corruption that happened in the previous regime, everyone's sort of getting in on the project. Now, today, for example, the parliament voted to give the president decree powers, basically to make elections happen in a timely fashion. The RCD, that's the former ruling party, was suspended. So this big, massive machine that was the arms, eyes, and ears of the president before, is ostensibly not going to be able to function. Fears of that, of course, are still keep people a little bit worried, but, you know, that's the idea. So they're getting it, I think, is the answer.
Okay. And the caretaker government that is in operation right now, does it include members of his political party, Ben Ali's political party?
No. The only one who it does have an affiliation is the prime minister, Mohamed Ghannouchi. Everyone else has been brought in from the outside, from everywhere. I mean, from Europe, from every which place. It's sort of like the greatest hits of Tunisian technocrats abroad.
Now, I understand there is one particular new member of the government we want to focus on. This is a blogger who was jailed during the protest last month. He was released, and he now has a new job in the government. He's got a very interesting story. Why don't you tell us?
Yeah, Slim Amamu. He's technically Minister for Youth and Sports, and he runs a computer company, but he's very well known for his free speech and freedom of the internet blogging. He tried to organize protests last spring after the government cracked down on a number of websites. So he was arrested. He was in prison over his online efforts to sort of promote free speech and freedom of information. And, you know, just at that time, after having been in prison a few days, that he was called to serve in this ministerial position. And he describes his role as giving a view into what's happening inside of government. So he'll directly tweet what's going on. Actually, they actually recently asked him to stop tweeting live because they were reading what he was tweeting while he was, you know, in the meeting with them.
Busted.
So, yeah.
Was it, but, by the way, was he being critical of the government he had just joined when he was tweeting in these meetings?
I think he's just being transparent, you know, saying, you know, this is what happened. And he's very much a person, you know, when you follow him on Twitter, he's very much a person that will throw in opinions from all over, even if they're critical of him, for example. So, you know, he has strong differences of opinion on whether or not any particular action is the best one to be taken, or, you know, people criticize him for even having joined in the first place. Some people call him a sellout. But he will include those opinions, and he includes everything.
Can you hold him up as an example of one of perhaps the new face of the Tunisian government, even in transition? Because on the other hand, it sounds like it would be impossible at this point to completely shed any of the practices or influences of the old president, who's now out, Ben Ali.
When you look at this new government, I mean, it's kind of extraordinary. You know, these people are technocrats and extremely educated, and many have taken pay cuts to do this work. But like you said, there are remnants in the government of the former regime. And I think, for example, in freedom of the press, yes, the press is largely free right now. But, you know, someone a little while back ordered the arrest and closure of one of the national TV stations, right? We still don't know where that came from.
And how about on the other hand, where do you see the freedom that wasn't there before?
The freedom is everywhere. I mean, if you just walk down the street, people are talking. They just nonstop talking politics. Anybody, people are chatting. And this is unheard of. I mean, before, you would have to look over your shoulder if you said the word Ben Ali, you know? So that's hugely different. The press can report on whatever it wants, which has never really been the case, and they're doing that. The internet, you can access websites. You can go to YouTube or Daily Motion or pretty much nothing is blocked except for porn and terrorist-related websites.
And you couldn't do any of that before?
No. I mean, to give you an example, the police would go and look at people's mobile phones to see if certain banned videos had been downloaded onto them.
Sabri, as you well know, people in Egypt were watching what's happening in Tunisia. Are Tunisians now watching what's happening in Egypt?
They are. I mean, and to a certain extent, they're extremely proud that they, you know, were able to launch this massive thing we're seeing around the Middle East. And they're also sort of looking with a little humor in that up until recently, it's been a sort of copy and paste, as they say, operation between Tunisia and Egypt. Right down to the speech that Mubarak gave was very, very similar to one that Ben Ali gave. So, you know, they're watching, and I think they're very proud that they've set an example.
Sabri Benachour, just back from Tunisia. He's a reporter for WAMU in Washington. Thank you very much, Sabri.
You're very welcome.
Now from Tunisia, let's head south for our GeoQuiz destination. We're looking for a West African country with Super Bowl bragging rights today. That's because one of the winners, the Green Bay Packers safety Charlie Peppra, has roots there. In fact, Peppra's grandfather once ran the West African nation. The rule ended badly, though. Military leader Ignatius Kutu Achampun was deposed and executed following a coup in 1979. His daughter fled the country with her husband shortly after that. The couple settled in Texas, and that's where they raised three sons, including Charlie. So, what West African nation are we looking for? You can find out right after our next report. And this next report is set about 2,400 miles east of the answer to today's quiz. We're going to Sudan. Today, electoral officials in southern Sudan published the final results of last month's referendum on independence. They confirmed that almost 99% of voters opted for separation from the north. Voters had several reasons for wanting to secede. One of the most important ones, frankly, is racism. From Khartoum, Matthew Brunwasser explains the different racial categories Sudanese people use to classify each other.
The name Sudan comes from Bilad al-Sudan, Arabic for the land of the blacks. So you might expect Sudanese to be comfortable with the color of their skin, but they're not.
They are equating black with dullness. So a black person is stupid, automatically a slave.
Southerner Agnes Silver Nyarsuk explains that southern Sudanese consider themselves black, while northerners see themselves as Arabs and treat blacks as second class.
For transport, an Arab lady, when she enters, the men will stand up and give the place for an Arab lady because she's a woman. But a black lady, even if she's old and she's shivering, dying, they will not respect because you are automatically a slave.
The differences between north and south might seem like one of religion, but that's only a secondary conflict. Most northerners are Muslims, and most southerners follow traditional African religions or Christianity. Sudanese journalist Gottfried Victor Bula has written extensively on race issues. He says even when northerners and southerners are the same religion, perceived racial differences keep them apart.
An Arab look at a black southerner, despite the fact he's a Muslim, but they look at him as inferior. Somebody, you know, you're nothing. You're nothing. So this attitude grows bigger and bigger.
In South Africa's apartheid system of racial division, the white power structure was easy to see. Sudan's apartheid isn't so clear-cut. If the president of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, were to walk down a street in Washington, D.C., he'd be considered black. But journalist Gottfried Victor Bula says not in Sudan.
Bashir is an Arab. Bashir is not black. Bashir is a kind of a chocolate kind of a color. It's a color which is not black totally.
What we have been fighting is Arab racism, apartheid in the Sudan.
Retired Southern General Joseph Lagu led the first armed resistance against the North in 1963. He says institutionalized racism is what led Southerners to war against their northern neighbors. He blames the 19th-century British war hero, Lord Horatio Kitchener, for the racist attitudes held by northern Sudanese even today.
The racism which the British brought, Lord Kitchener, planted it here, divided the people in the Sudan in four categories.
The top category was the white race, represented by Kitchener and the people he brought, followed by the Arab Egyptians, who made up much of his army. Category three were the Sudanese working as servants and porters. And at the bottom were black southerners. So it's logical that the post-independence elite who have ruled the country since 1956 see themselves as Arabs, Khartoum-based analyst Al-Bakir Mukhtar.
They associated themselves and identified themselves with Arabs. Although they are not accepted by the Arabs, but they claim to be Arabs. And although they are not really Arabs, they are Nubians, they are indigenous people of Sudan who've been Arabized in a way that their language become Arabic and their religion become Islam. That's all. But their looks remain Africans.
Mukhtar says Sudanese people have a wide spectrum of skin colors and concepts of skin color to match.
And we describe the color of another who is very black, we call him green. Although two different people, one southerner and one northerner, having the same color, when we describe the southerner, we call him black. When it describes the northerner, they call him green.
Mukhtar says that North Sudanese rarely admit there's such thing as racism, so the mentality will likely persist for the foreseeable future. But with South Sudan set to officially declare independence in July, the North will have to deal with Southerners as a sovereign country and not as an internal minority. And that will be key to future stability and relations between the two states. For The World, I'm Matthew Brunwasser, Khartoum, Sudan.
You can find slideshows from our reporting on the Sudanese referendum during the past couple of months. They are at theworld.org. Briefly now, the answer to our GeoQuiz today. Green Bay Packers safety Charlie Pepper was born in Texas, but his family roots are in Ghana. Ghana being the West African nation we wanted you to name for our GeoQuiz. Pepper's dad flew in from Ghana to attend the Super Bowl yesterday, and happily for both father and the son, the Packers won. By the way, Charlie Pepper is not the first Texas-born NFL player with Ghanaian roots to win the Super Bowl. He was preceded in 2007 by Super Bowl champ the Indianapolis Colts running back Joseph Addai. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World. Social networking sites such as Twitter, Facebook, and Flickr make it easy to share our lives online, but too much sharing can backfire. People have been fired or have seen their marriages fall apart thanks to a picture posted online that they had forgotten about. The European Union is working to tighten its policies on digital privacy. As part of that, many are suggesting a right to be forgotten online. And numerous projects are underway to give people just that kind of option. The World's technology correspondent Clark Boyd reports.
Back in 2009, a book came out entitled Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in a Digital Age. Its author is Victor Meyer Schoenberger.
I suggested that we should have a renaissance of forgetting, a revival of forgetting in a digital age. And one way of doing this, I suggested, was through expiration dates of information.
Fast forward to 2011. German computer researchers have developed Expire, a system that allows you to put just such an expiration date on your photos. Michael Backus heads the Expire project.
We just realized that more and more people joined social networks, and they tended to put in much information on the very first day, including many, many pictures that later on, well, became disadvantages for their job search and also for their private life.
A user downloads the Expire software to his or her machine, uses it to encrypt photos, and then specifies the date when those photos should go away. The photos can then be uploaded to social networking sites. Then you wait for the expiration date, says Backus.
Once the specific date has been reached, the key server will just not give out this key anymore. So it's like a time protection. Whenever this expiration date has been reached, the key is not accessible anymore, and nobody on Earth can still view this image.
And Expire is not the only group working on this. There's also Vanish, headed by Yoshi Kono at the University of Washington. He says his group is working to do something similar with the text users post online. Kono says that Vanish, like any such expiration date system, still has potential holes in it.
The limitations of this approach is that if someone has access to the data before the timeout and they intentionally want to preserve a copy of that data, they can still do so. The simplest example might be is that if you send an email to a friend and they want to keep a copy forever, they can take a photo of the screen.
Expire's Michael Backus admits that there's currently no ultimate solution to securing online privacy. But he says Expire is pushing ahead. In the future, he says, he can imagine many different applications for the technology.
You can use this for let whole web pages, whole blocks expire if you want. You can use it on video. I mean, other things that we are currently investigating is a full automation. Make it fully integrated into the browsing process, which means whenever you upload to Facebook, you just fully automatically set a predefined expiration date.
Currently, Expire only works this way with the Firefox browser. And the cost? About $3.50 per month.
Yeah! Girlies, you're on film!
A small price, some might say, for having some incriminating evidence from your college years automatically remove itself from YouTube before a potential employer finds it. For The World, this is Clark Boyd.
Now, on to today's global hit. This is South African singer-songwriter Vusi Malasela. Back home, he's dubbed The Voice. Vusi Malasela's laid-back acoustic feel doesn't always sync with what's in his lyrics. They're often political. He's known for singing about the struggle for freedom and about forgiveness and reconciling with enemies. On his new album, Say Africa, the title track looks at an Africa with no borders.
Say Africa, say Africa, say Africa.
And stones and the UN loan and the passport controls for countries that don't exist. It's a big world, they have their own problems everywhere, and there's gold in that clenched fist.
Vusi Malasela recorded Say Africa at a studio owned by fellow South African Dave Matthews. Malasela enlisted another familiar name, bluesman Taj Mahal, to produce the album. They perform together on this song, In Anyway.
I'm amazed by your patience, this work and understanding.
Vusi Malasela is now touring the United States to promote the album. You can find out if he's coming to a city near you on our website, theworld.org. That's it for us today. Our Boston team includes Stephen Snyder and Mary Lou Ward. In London, Rob Hugh Jones and Ian Rosser. The world's engineers are Robin Moore, Tina Toby, and Mike Wilkins. Our online team includes Stephen Davey, Michael Rass, and Manya Gupta. And we're always online at theworld.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins. We're back tomorrow. We'll be right back.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Plowshares Fund, investing in peace and security worldwide, plowshares.org. The National Science Foundation, where discoveries begin. More information online at nsf.gov. The Freeman Foundation, and by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. Information at macfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.